Good morning. Welcome, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm publisher of The Atlantic, and I wanted to welcome you to our Day of Ideas here in New York. New York is the last stop in a five-city tour celebrating The Atlantic's 150th anniversary, and we're very pleased to have you all here with us today. Across our history, we have had publications from statesmen, historians, and pioneers, including several U.S. presidents, Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, Theodore Roosevelt, Harry Truman. I thought I'd begin with a nod to our past and a passage by Woodrow Wilson that fits the theme of our session. Even back in 1902, our president and scholar was concerned about the pressure of progress for American people and industry. How can we continue to innovate, or where will it all end? And Wilson wrote then in 1902 in The Atlantic, "That rolling, resistless tide, incalculable in its strength, infinite in its variety, has made us what we are, has put the resources of a huge continent at our disposal, has provoked us to invention, and given us mighty captains of industry. This great pressure of a people moving always to new frontiers in search of new lands, new power, the full freedom of a virgin world, who shall say where it will end?" And that is the topic we will take up today with our panel on the weighty issue of can we compete, America in the global marketplace? And sitting in the last session, I was thinking this is appropriate in this room because we have looking down on us Africa, Asia, Europe, if you look around at the tapestries. So and here we are, America in the global marketplace. This is a conversation that we've hosted in each of the five cities that we've been in on our tour with a slightly revolving cast of panelists. And across the entire tour, though, we've been fortunate to have Ernst & Young as our sponsor, helping to make it possible for us to bring together great minds with our readers across the country. Ernst & Young has been a partner to The Atlantic for some time now, helping us to convene thoughtful dialogue on key business issues of the day, and doing a series looking at restoring trust in capital markets, and now a series on the U.S. competitiveness around the globe. Ernst & Young and The Atlantic invite you to continue our conversation when we break, which will be around 12:10 or 12:15, with a light lunch to be hosted in this room. And it's my great pleasure in thanking Ernst & Young to introduce John Thomopoulos, who's a partner with the financial services practice of EY.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to my hometown. I'm a born and bred New Yorker. For those of you visiting, welcome. And for those of you who share that background with me, you know how passionate we are about being New Yorkers. And the concept of globalization being based in New York, I truly believe we are the financial capital of the world. And what we are about to talk about is perfect for the setting of here in the Public Library of New York. On behalf of my partners and our people of Ernst & Young, I'd like to welcome you to this town hall. The question of can we compete, America in the global marketplace? We believe at Ernst & Young that there needs to be a dialogue, a very loud dialogue on this topic, on many points of view of this issue. The United States' competitiveness in the capital markets impacts our business sectors, ability to access capital easily and inexpensively, and the effectiveness of markets not only here in the United States but throughout the world, and the prospects of industry, both service and manufacturing, in all regions, and ultimately the debate on the impact of investors. On a personal level, each of us in this room, our competitiveness will impact our standard of living, the mobility and the career prospects for ourselves and future generation of Americans and future generations to come. At the end of this discussion, we do invite you to join us for a discussion and dialogue, as Elizabeth said, with coffee and a light lunch. At this time, I'd like to hand the mic over to Clive Crook, the senior editor of The Atlantic. Clive joined The Atlantic about a year and a half ago from The Economist, of where he was there for approximately 20 years. He has made the move from London to Georgetown, I believe, in Washington. Welcome to the United States, Clive. I'm sure you've been here often, but now that you're here, part of us. He is a graduate of Oxford and the London School of Economics. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Clive. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well, thank you all for coming. We're very compressed for time this morning. I warn you about that at the outset. As well as being compressed for space, I don't think I've ever been so intimately accommodated on a platform with a panel of distinguished speakers before. And I'm in imminent danger of falling off. So if you see that happening, give me a shout. Well, at the broadest level, the topic that's just been advertised, U.S. competitiveness, is so broad, it's almost impossible to address in a short span of time. But luckily, we intend to drill down into that topic a little more narrowly for the purposes of this discussion. And what we're going to be focused on here is the implications or the connections between American finance, American capital markets, and American prosperity. There are many other aspects of the broad issue of competitiveness, and I don't want to deflect you from raising these in questions towards the end. We'll give over the second half to questions. But at least for the first half of this discussion, we're going to concentrate on finance and exploit the expertise of my fellow panelists. Let me introduce them without further ado. First of all, Dick Cavanna, who is the president and CEO of the Conference Board, which is one of the world's preeminent not-for-profit business intelligence research firms, previously the executive dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We have Jack Coffey, who is professor of law at Columbia University in New York, head of the university's Center on Corporate Governance, a renowned authority on that subject, and the author of a new book, which I'm currently reading and warmly recommend, called The Gatekeepers, which is an authoritative discussion of many of the issues we're going to be touching on today. We have Bill McDonough, vice chairman of Merrill Lynch, former chairman of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, and for 10 years, as I'm sure you all know, president and CEO of the New York Fed. And finally, Tom Russo, who is vice chairman of Lehman Brothers, in charge of their corporate advisory division, and another leading, genuinely global authority on law and financial markets. If you're putting a panel together to discuss the subject of American finance and American economy and the interface between that domain and law and regulation, and you could just choose any four people in the world, you probably choose these four people. So I just want you to understand that this is an incredibly distinguished group. Let me try and frame, just take 2 minutes to frame the topic that we're going to be discussing. The issue is really whether America's preeminence in finance, which has been so much taken for granted and for so long has been a source of American economic vitality, whether that preeminence is going to be sustained. Now, there are some reasons to suspect that it's under threat. One is the danger of declining public confidence in American finance, and in fact, in American capitalism more generally, that followed the dot-com crash, and especially the corporate scandals of recent years, WorldCom, Enron, and all the rest. Now, there was a regulatory backlash to those scandals, Sarbanes-Oxley, and other initiatives, and some people argue that those measures are actually adding to the problem, that they were in some respects an overreaction or an incompetent reaction to the problem. And this too is now adding to the problem of lack of confidence in the capital markets. And a third factor, which is particularly noticeable to me as a foreigner, is America's, I will call it America's litigation culture. I think it's increasingly the case that to become a CEO in America or a director of a public company or a finance professional exposes you to risks through litigation that you just don't face in those lines of work in other countries anywhere else in the world. I'm a little surprised that this aspect of our subject, isn't discussed in America more than it is. I know for a fact that it's on the minds of many Europeans who are contemplating a move to America. I think that's a big subject, and I'm hoping we'll be able to get at least a couple of our panelists to address it in the course of this discussion. Well, here's how we'll organize the discussion. I don't want to try to impose any particular structure or agenda on the meeting. I'm just going to put a question, a fairly general question, to each of our panelists and invite them to speak for a short while. I've encouraged them to respond to each other's comments in a conversational style so that we can get some kind of interchange going. And then just to repeat, About halfway through, in about half an hour, I will turn the panel over to you for questions on either what we've been discussing or any aspect of the broader issue of American competitiveness. Well, I thought I'd start with Bill McDonough, if that's all right, and ask you, Bill, if you could just help us to see why this issue of American capital markets, why the question of America's, the depth and the integrity of American capital markets, why that matters for the American economy more broadly, why that's even a concern.
Well, I think the United States is the most competitive economy in the world. In the real economy, we adjusted in the mid-1990s to the reality of globalization by lifting the American economy essentially by investing in it, free investment by business leaders in order to improve labor force productivity. So the economy that could only grow at 2.5% per year, labor force productivity plus the growth in the labor force, from 1973 to 1995, as of 95, 96, it boomed, and we could grow the economy at 3.5%, 4% per year. What happened in the latter part of the 90s is that we were doing that superbly, but at the same time, largely because of the reality of stock options as an important part of compensation, there was a growing apart of the American people and American investors from the people who ran companies. In 1980, the average CEO made 40 times more than the average salary of the people who worked for him or her. By the year 2000, it was about 400 times. That was kind of irritating a lot of American people because the American dream is supposed to be, well, I can be like him if he makes 40 times more, but 400 times? Right. Maybe I'll never be able to get there. The result of that was that when the scandals came along, American investors said, my God, how can we invest in companies if you can't trust their financial statements? And the American people said, I've decided I don't like those guys running companies anyway. That has to be understood to understand Sarbanes-Oxley. Nobody has been put in jail for violating Sarbanes-Oxley. Nobody. They got put in jail for violating laws that have been on the books for many, many years. Sarbanes-Oxley said, we want American companies to be run differently, and it passed 97-0 in the Senate, 4 negative votes in the House of Representatives. You cannot get a resolution in favor of Mother's Day with greater majorities than that. And then a highly conservative president said it's the most important securities legislation since 1934-35, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president of the United States. You have to understand Sarbanes-Oxley and what's going on in light of this attitude on the part of the American people. So that's why we have to get, and we are making immense progress in restoring confidence in the credibility of American financial statements and in the people running American companies. I think we're making great progress.
Okay. Jack, maybe you could pick that point up on Sarbanes-Oxley and how it fits into the wider issue of how we fix these problems in capital markets.
Well, let me start by endorsing everything that Bill just said. I think historically, United States public corporations have had a lower cost of capital than their rivals in Europe. And that's because investors here had greater trust and confidence in the company's published financial statements and reports. Now, to the extent that you have a more confidence in the published numbers, investors demand a lower risk premium over what they would demand in another company where the markets are more opaque, where information is produced in a far more selective, episodic fashion, and where financial statements and the oversight government regulator is not nearly as rigorous. The point here is that optimal securities regulation does more than just protect the widows and orphans out there that we all want to protect. It also should reduce the cost of capital. When you do that, you benefit not only investors, you affect the gross national product, you make the whole economy stronger. That's what's at stake here. But there is a problem. And let me give you just one statistic to point out the problem. In 2000, 9 out of 10 foreign issuers, 9 out of 10 dollars raised by foreign issuers in IPOs, new public offerings, were raised in the United States. In 2005, 9 out of 10 dollars by foreign issuers in new public offerings were raised outside the United States. That's a precipitous change. You cannot blame that really on Sarbanes-Oxley because all of this was happening. It began in the mid-1990s and hit rock bottom about 2001. So Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't have a direct causal responsibility. There are some modest adjustment
problems. Well, what was it then?
Problems.
If it wasn't Starbucks, what did
it? I think it is two things that is making the foreign issuer community extremely disenchanted with the United States markets. One is a true distaste for what they see as U.S. legal imperialism, under which the U.S. believes that it has to establish the rules for all transactions, even though it has only a tenuous connection to the transaction. Oh. Two is what you pointed to already, a litigation environment that seems out of control to Europe. That's both civil and criminal litigation. They resent both of them, but they see private enforcement through class actions as something bizarre and beyond their understanding. I'm going to give you just one example, bring this home with a simple example. If you are a foreign issuer, you might enter the U.S. today in a toehold, modest, tentative way by listing a small quantity of stock through ADRs on an exchange. 1% of your capital is traded in the U.S. But if you have a stock drop in Europe, your stock price falls 25% for any reason. What will happen in the United States is the plaintiff's bar will sue not just on behalf of the U.S. investors, but they will seek to bring a worldwide class action for multiple billions of dollars that threatens the corporate solvency of the company. You can't settle. You can't really litigate and go to trial in a multi-billion dollar class. Right. You need to settle. Sure. The message for the foreign issuer today is even a toehold entry to the U.S. puts you at risk for your very financial solvency because this worldwide class action may get brought that you have to settle. That's an area where I think we're seeing both litigation and U.S. legal imperialism. I don't think the U.S. has to be the worldwide arbitrator of what went wrong for citizens on five different continents. And if we say that, companies will stay offshore.
That's really interesting. Tom, can I get your take on that? Do you agree that the litigation issue is as big a deal as Jack's just been saying?
Well, one of my jobs at Lehman is the chief legal officer. I normally don't admit that in public, but it is one of my jobs there. And so I get to see the litigation firsthand. And I think what Jack said is true. If you feel that the probability of winning an action is, say, 70 or 80%, it never can be greater than 80%. Anytime there's a jury trial, no matter how good the facts are, you could lose it. And if the amount involved is relatively small, I'm using big numbers, but it'd be relatively small in the scheme of things, say 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 million dollars, you would litigate that case because of the probabilities. But once you get into the billion-dollar range, you really have to think twice. And then when it gets to be $2, $3, and $4 billion, it's very difficult to litigate the case, no matter what the probabilities are. So you could have a very frivolous action, or relatively frivolous action, and be forced into a settlement mode. Now, put that in the context of U.S. competitiveness, which is why we're here. One of the figures that's often used is last year, 24 out of 25 of the global IPOs were outside the United States. This year, 9 out of 10 of the biggest IPOs global were outside the United States. And what's happening is other countries are getting more. For example, London just a few years ago had went dramatically up from, I think it's 5% to 25%. And increasing. And what's also happening is people, when they come into the United States, they're going increasingly under what's called 144A, which is essentially a private transaction where you don't have to register and you're not subject fundamentally to most of the U.S. regulations, as opposed to using the public markets. I asked our capital market group, because I'm involved with I'm on a steering committee, a group studying this, and Jack is an advisor to that same group. I asked them just to talk to our clients and say, well, why do you go to Europe or why do you go elsewhere and not to the United States? And the reason is pretty simple, that the environment in the United States is just not good for corporations to be in. If you get here, you get sued. And what's happened with Sarbanes-Oxley, I mean, I personally think it went overboard, not the law, but some of the implementation of it. But it's not Sarbanes-Oxley really, but Sarbanes-Oxley became sort of a tipping point. It's sort of a code word for everything else that has been wrong in the legal environment in the United States, whether it be regulation by enforcement, whether it be class actions, whether it be all the necessary work that's been done on Sarbanes-Oxley and sometimes the exclusion of other work, whatever it is. SOX became a code word for that. Mm. So foreign issuers just simply don't want to be here. And ultimately, if this continues, it's going to be a major problem, because we're going to we're beginning to lose now, but we will be losing more and more and more of one of the major industries. And just to get give you an idea, just the financial services industry, which is a huge industry, not more than just the securities industry, is about 8.7% of the GDP of the United States. New York State gets about 19% of its revenues from this industry in taxes. So it's not just about companies like ourselves. And ironically, it's companies like ourselves and Merrill Lynch. In some sense, we don't really care, because if we do an IPO abroad or we do an IPO in the United States, you know, we still get paid either way. We get paid slightly more in the United States. But why? In part, because there's a bit of a litigation premium that's put on the underwriting spread. The underwriting spread in the United States is on average about 5.6%. In Europe, it's roughly 3.6%. So, but that, you, if you look at the money you spend in lawyers' fees alone, I mean, our company spends in total legal fees about $250 million a year. And that's more than, you know, most people in this room make. And
now half of that goes to Tom.
I was going to say, yeah.
So I think that's it has a stigma in the United States that it's just not a great place to do business in this industry.
This will seem like an odd question for a journalist to ask, but why isn't this more written about? This is not a very common perception, is it? It doesn't seem to figure very much in the political debate. Sarbox, yes, that's controversial, that's a big deal, or at least it was. I think that debate is fading too. But one doesn't hear a great deal about the effects of the litigation culture on finance and competitiveness. Why is that?
Let me add one point about this. It's only been over the last 5 years or so that the numbers in securities class actions have soared to the point they're actually threatening the solvency of corporations. Time was a very big class action settled for under $100 million. Mm-hmm. They're now settling for over $1 billion fairly commonly. And in the aggregate, about 5 years ago, the total amount of dollars paid in securities class actions was under $500 million. If you look at 2005, and you throw the Enron settlement of about $7 billion onto all other class actions, you get a number that's between $16 and $17 billion. That is macroeconomic significance.
Right. I think, though, it's important to understand that the legal issues we're talking about are basically a protection racket or an extortion racket that's run by a handful of law firms against a very small group of extremely affluent clients. I've been sued twice as a director by Milberg Weiss, which is a law firm that currently is under investigation for its recruitment of plaintiffs. Right. And I'll explain how it works.
This is all, by the way, the cover story in this month's Fortune magazine goes through the entire thing about how they did it.
But I'll give you an example. I'm a director of an insurance company. A plaintiff goes and buys 17 insurance policies for $10,000 from 17 different insurance companies. They happen to be the 17 largest insurance companies in the United States.
As luck would have it.
All in a period of a month, this one man. Can you imagine the number of physical exams you had to go through to, you know, and, you know, answer in dealing with 17 insurance agents in a month? But anyway, so he then says, you know what? All of these illustrations for this insurance I bought were fraudulent because they all said that I might actually not have to pay as much a premium in the future as I do now if the stock market goes well. And, you know, here it is 6 months later and my premium hasn't gone down. I'll sue. Now, the deal is that the law firm basically wants to get paid a settlement on behalf of all of the people who bought life insurance during that month period. And you know, and the fees, the legal fees are the first thing that they seek to be covered. So 16 of the insurance companies settled. My company, because we were outraged by this, did not take legal the advice of our lawyers, but said, this is crazy. You know, we don't want, we've done nothing wrong. And so we proceeded to litigate it. It cost us a couple million dollars in fees. The case was dismissed with prejudice by the federal court. Now, the issue. We won, but they won.
It cost you $2 million.
Okay, because the system works that most people say, oh, gosh, we'll go before a jury, we could actually lose, and so on and so forth. So it really is kind of an extortion racket. Now, why don't we hear about it? One, the people who are sued are not very sympathetic defendants. I mean, these are the fat cats who are getting sued. The second thing is that the plaintiff's bar is to the Democratic Party as evangelist Christians are to the Republican Party. Okay, extremely important as an interest group, and so there's a whole group of the political world that doesn't want to discuss this, and the people that are having the problem are so unsympathetic because basically they're the ones who are making 400 times what the average worker is who are getting sued. So who cares? So that's why I think it's an issue that has...
And it all comes out, remember, to the shareholders, because ultimately the companies pay, and there's something I've been saying for years, and I noticed it in an article you just wrote, that that if you're a pension fund, right, we all, or a mutual fund, so we're all involved in this in some way, and you own lots of different stocks through the pension fund, through the mutual fund, what happens is that, by and large, the money is going from one corporation to the shareholders of another corporation, and you basically are the same, except for the huge amount that gets pulled out in legal fees, settlement fees, and what have you that come out of the pot, so that the American public as a whole doesn't benefit. By this. It just does not. But the lawyers wind up in billions and billions of dollars getting benefit. But that, I think, is the small part of the problem. The bigger part is that if you ask any CEO anywhere in the world outside the United States about the U.S., they will tell you, they will say, you know, if I can avoid it, I will avoid it. I just don't want to get sued. I don't want to spend that time in court. It is just given what is an enormously competitive market, a market where there's the least expensive market to raise money because of the liquidity. It's given all these enormous competitive advantages we have, and it's taken it that CEOs, and this is not theory, you don't get 24 out of 25 IPOs abroad when you have the most competitive market right here. That there's got to be a reason for it. And the reason, when you talk to the people, is that they just don't want to be in this environment.
I think one of the things that has to be done, which is very easy to say and very difficult to do, is we have to get back in the pre-2000 period when the American people in general and the American business leadership felt that they were in the same game, right, and it was a game that everybody could win. Most American business leaders are thoroughly decent, honest people. They fall into the trap of saying, gee, we're mostly honest people, and so they're just a couple of bad apples. Well, that isn't what the American people think.
Right.
And so the leadership, they're making progress through the Business Roundtable, through Dick's operation, the Conference Board, through the Aspen Institute Corporate Governance Program. There is a beginning of a real effort in which people like me are extremely actively involved to try to restore the confidence of the American people in the private sector. Until and if we win that social and political battle, we're not going to have the American people restore their view that a dynamic, wonderful private sector is good for me and good for my kids and good for my grandchildren.
Right.
That's the game that has to be won.
That is absolutely the fundamental thing. But let me just come back. Maybe this is what you wanted to pick up, Jack. I think a lot of people listening to you say that would still feel that there is there is an issue here that, you know, that a lot of U.S. CEOs have only themselves to blame. A lot of boards have only themselves to blame for this a sort of culture of heightened suspicion and resentment, because it is actually a fact that CEO pay for the biggest American companies has gone through the ceiling over the past 5 to 10 years, at a time when median earnings have been rising more slowly than inflation. What is the American public to make of that?
Well, they know what they make of it. They don't like it.
But what?
And
what's
I think
the answer?
I mean, I think business leadership over time has to go back to the game that you actually pay for performance. I think the bad thing about executive compensation is not whether a guy who runs a company or a woman who runs a company very well makes a load of money. Most Americans would say right on,
right,
for the same reason they think A-Rod does, right, even if he isn't great in the World Series, but League Series. I think what happens is when somebody makes a lot of money,
perception is money for no performance.
For no performance.
Right.
And that is really not how the game's supposed to be played. And that's what the people see, and that's what they don't like.
And do you think that is that Jack, is that an accurate reflection of what's going on? Or is this something that the media is getting?
Let me say two things in response to what you're saying. I'm sitting on the far left of this panel, and I have to point out that one of the reasons the U.S. has had a lower cost of capital is that its securities laws are more rigorously enforced. Mm-hmm. Law on the books doesn't mean that much. It's law as it's enforced,
right,
that has the real impact on the cost of capital, on what investors see. I think there is a role for private enforcement of securities laws. I don't think all securities litigation is frivolous, but I think right now the securities class action has become dysfunctional because, as Tom was starting to say, it basically results in this pocket-shifting wealth transfer.
Sure.
It's ultimately shareholders suing shareholders for a recovery that goes from diversified shareholders to diversified shareholders, minus this 50% tax for lawyers' fees. That does systematically destroy the wealth of investors without getting anything desirable into the system. Now, to your point, I mean, we need to refashion our litigation system, but I think there is a role for private enforcement, and we have that lower cost of capital because we do enforce
our. Is there a straightforward fix, a politically feasible
fix? I think
there
are a number, but it's highly technical. Let me take your second point about executive compensation, and I agree with much of what Bill is saying. The funny thing is the consistency. We had this huge scandal in 2001 and 2002 in terms of corporate financial statements, where the basic problem was the premature recognition of income,
right,
as managers tried to inflate the books to get the stock price up because they were now compensated in stock options. That was all a change in the 1990s. We went from cash compensation to equity compensation in the space of about 7 or 8 years, a very rapid change, and corporate governance never keeps up with the market. It's always about 5 to 10 years behind because it needs scandals before it moves. Now we have a new scandal, stock options. And guess what? It's the same underlying force.
Right.
If they're no longer cooking the books, they're now backdating the options. In the future, I think we'll see Sarbanes actually has solved this problem. We're no longer going to see the backdating of stock options. We will for the future see what I'll call the manipulation of financial results. You'll put out the bad news on day one, drive the price down, issue the stock option at the low price, put out the good news on day three, and the stock will be issued in the middle of this vortex. That kind of game is very hard to enforce, but behind all this...
That sounds like the worst possible outcome to me.
Well, we have this problem that this rapid change to equity compensation, which is here to stay, we're not going to go away from stock options and equity, does produce a lot of managers gaming the system, and it needs boards that I think are monitoring this and trying to signal to the marketplace that they want to curb this. I think there are ways, again, that are technical that you can curb it.
We should remind the audience briefly how all this stock option stuff got started. The Congress, in all its dignity in 1993, passed a law which was signed by the president saying a company could not expense any compensation for an individual more than $1 million a year unless it's performance related. Hello, stock options.
Right.
This was the undesired, obviously, because it was pushed actually by people from the center left. Senator Levin of Massachusetts was the original sponsor of the bill. And it looked good at the time. The consequences have just been horrendous.
Right. The unintended consequence was that $1 million, which became the ceiling, actually became the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Because no self-respecting CEO who was making less than $1 million, you know, figured, well, if this is the statutory, you know, statement of what you're supposed to get for being there, then I want it. And then what they did in committee language is they said, and by the way, stock options are a form of compensation that is performance related. And at that point, stock options were free, meaning if you paid somebody in stock options, you didn't have to record it as an expense. It was just kind of, you know, free
play money.
Money. And so guess what?
Unintended consequences.
Yeah, unintended consequences.
Well, I've got more questions of my own, but I promised to give the audience a chance. So, sir, do we have is there a microphone? Or maybe we don't need a microphone. It's not a big room.
Is globalization itself affecting the way, affecting business? What I'm thinking of or asking, is it affecting ownership of companies? Is it affecting activism to some extent? We're seeing today some transparency in financial reporting. We may not have the same comparable transparency yet in regulation, but what about simply, does it matter where you do business because of globalization and the companies change?
Right. Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I think what's happened, because companies have developed better regulatory systems. UK is a good example with their FSA, because firms are global in nature, because there's just a fluidity. I think people are able to go other places to do things. And I think what you see, and all the data backs this up, is that people will wind up doing business where there is adequate regulation, but not what they perceive to be over-regulation. And that's why you're having a significant, by any measure, shift out of the United States, and that's what's happening, because these markets are now real. In the past, they weren't. They're regulated. In the past, they weren't as regulated. And firms are global. And so much of the liquidity is institutional in nature. And this is the irony. You talk about unintended consequences. I was trying to think of that movie, Bruce Almighty, where this guy wanted to be God, Bruce, and Morgan Freeman let him be God. And then he did a lot of things. And then there were unintended consequences. He brings the moon down while he's dating this woman, and there floods in India. All sorts of unintended consequences. And I think what's happened in this country is a lot of the legislation, even class actions, what have you, whether it be Section 162M, which we were talking about before, the tax law on deductibility, all of these things have these incredible unintended consequences. And as a result, people are just deciding, because they have the mechanism. And one of the unintended consequences is, because of the institutionalization, large institutional players can buy into securities. If you're a U.S. firm and you want to buy something, there's no reason you have to buy it in this country. You could buy it outside of this country, and you could buy it in this country through this, what I said, 144M, through a sort of a private offering. But if you're a common folk in this, the public investor, you then get foreclosed from buying any of these, except to the extent that you're involved in a mutual fund or what have you as an investor there. But you cannot do that. So the market, a lot of these rules, which were intended to protect the people who are reading the newspapers and the people who are concerned about these things, get foreclosed now from an awful lot of transactions. Some of it, maybe it's good they get foreclosed from. But they don't have the option to go into them, except that they're in mutual funds or where they're.
I think in brief, let me see if I can give you a shorter answer. In brief, you have a globalized economy, and you have the nation state providing the legal jurisdiction. If you're running a globalized company, you simply, in the interest of your shareholders, have to take advantage of that, and you locate your activities in tax havens. And they're not funny places. Ireland runs one of the most successful economies in the world because it is absolutely genius at encouraging people to produce pharmaceuticals, to produce information services in the Irish Republic. And people take advantage of that. The nature of our ability to actually deal as world citizens with this phenomenon is very limited, because nobody's thinking that for a globalized economy you're going to have a globalized system of governance. And therefore, I think what we have to do, especially again as business leaders, to try to restore the confidence, is it has to be very clear that these things that we're doing are reasonable, and we're not playing funny games just for the sake of fattening up the bottom line in a way that is ultimately expensive. Because to go back to what Dr. Coffey has been saying, the real name of the game is to reduce the cost of capital. You do that not by playing games, but by having investors have confidence in the management.
Take another question. But I just can't help but point out that the European Union is leaning very heavily on Ireland at the moment to increase its corporate tax rate.
Led by the British, I hope not.
Not by the British, but there's an attempt to stamp out that advantage, which is interesting. Madam. Well, there's a...
Well, your statements...
Thank you for the simple version of the
question. Your statements are historically accurate. We have had a requirement that public companies have adequate internal control systems since 1976. It was underenforced. Now, my basic point was that the U.S. does a better job of enforcement than other countries, but that provision was underenforced, and Sarbanes-Oxley, in this very controversial provision called Section 404, requires today an annual audit, which is really putting teeth into that provision, because the auditor comes forward and tells you whether or not you have a material weakness. I think that provision needs a shakedown cruise. There's going to be some modification of it, but I think it's important, and I strongly support the idea that tough internal controls will reduce the cost of capital in the long run. Why didn't we have a better system? Remember, who hires the watchdog? If management hires the watchdog, it may sometimes prefer to have a lapdog than a watchdog. One of the things that Sarbanes-Oxley did was give control over internal controls from management to the audit committee. And I think the audit committee is the appropriate repository for that responsibility. It, first of all, will be somewhat risk-averse, and you want the audit committee to be a little risk-averse in this area. Others may want to comment on that.
Let me comment, since I had an awful lot to do as chairman of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board with seeing this implemented. Not unrelated to the shock of the scandals and the concern for litigation, even companies that in fact had very good internal controls, and there were some who did, tightened them up even further. And then a lot of companies that didn't have much in the way of internal controls were putting in an internal controls in a medium-sized company that might have been appropriate for IBM or General Electric, but were absolutely crazy for them. Then the auditors came along, who were also desperately worried about litigation. They knew a lot about Arthur Andersen collapsing. And so what the best bet for an auditor is, don't take any risks. Inspect the hell out of everything, and then nobody can sue you for not having done enough work. Now, what One of the things the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board has said it's doing it in its inspections of the audit firms is they will castigate them for doing too much work. In other words, we need to restore a balance for how much internal control do you really need depending on your business, and how much internal control does the auditor really have to check before you're just doing it either for the sake of doing it or for avoiding litigation or running up the fees. This has to be improved so you get a much better cost-benefit relationship out of
it. But doesn't that leave the auditors in an impossible position with, you know, litigators out there ready to pounce on any mistake?
Sure,
and the regulator's saying you're overdoing it.
That's why the main audit firms are saying we would like protection from litigation.
Yeah. I mean, the analogy is that that auditors fulfilling Section 404 are like physicians who are dealing with a medical examination in a highly litigious area where it's kind of, let's do every test. You know, if we have to CAT scan the toes, we have to CAT scan the toes, but we're going to make sure that we've done everything that we can do. And I think that, that during the early 404 things, that there were lots and lots of CAT scans that got done that probably don't need to be done every year, if ever.
Take another question. I've lost track of who was first. You, sir, you.
I had a question about the rise of buyout firms taking companies public, giving themselves huge service fees, and then taking the company public and trying to cash out that way. You know, if you're talking about can American companies compete, you know, these companies that are being bought out probably weren't competitive to begin with, but we're seeing a huge rise in this, and these companies are competing with one hand tied behind their backs. If they have to pay huge fees to the buyout firms plus compete against competitors that don't have that burden.
That's a good question. Dick, do you want to start on that?
Sure. I mean, buyout firms are not new to this culture. Okay, Mr. Carnegie, who built this library, was the first buyout king. Okay, just to kind of put this in some context. But given that, you've got an enormous increase in buyout activity, and you know. Some people believe that there is so much money